Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
We have two guests for today's show. In our first segment, we'll be joined in a moment by Chef Barbara Lynch, the Boston powerhouse and restaurant mogul. And also, Jimmy, just we learned what, a minute ago, named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world.
In the world.
I hope, I dare say this has to be her first interview because I just heard this. And the reason we have her booked here is she's also the author of the new memoir, Out of Line, A Life Playing with Fire. And in our second segment, we have in the studio with us Chef Brock Johnson from the Dahlia Lounge in Seattle. But first, on the phone, I think, Barbara Lynch. Are you there, Barbara?
I'm here. Hi, Andrew. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I have to say, we had put a moratorium for any publicists who are out there listening. It wasn't a lie. We stopped doing phone interviews because we had some absolute cell phone disasters last year, and we said we're never doing another phone interview. And then we read Barbara's book, and the only way we could get her this close to publication was to do it on the phone. So we made an exception. And Jimmy, I think first of all, we have to just give a round of applause for the book.
Yeah,
I think we have to.
Huge.
Thank you,
Barbara. We love your book. We love your book.
Thanks.
And so far, the technical aspects are working nicely as well.
Yeah, so we can hear you.
I think I might be the only one alive who has a landline these days.
Interesting enough, I have a house in New England, and I have a landline, and when I have people over, they make fun of me. I have a box on a wall with a cord on it.
Right. And a rotary dial. Listen, Barbara, there's all these words that people toss around, you know, with books like brave, gritty, revealing, honest. These things have become a little cheap, I think. But this book, I think Jimmy would agree.
Yeah, maybe even add raw to that.
Yeah, and raw, just all of that. And congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
Can we just first take a moment? This is kind of going almost from the very last page of the book. You know, in the acknowledgments, you talk about your agent kind of persuading you and being persistent to do this project. Can you just talk for just a minute or two about how it came together and if there was a hesitancy to do it and how long it sort of took you to get through the whole process?
First I had a Google memoir. So I was like, what? I'm too young. I just didn't want to write it because, I just didn't feel like I had a story to tell, and she was really persistent. It took her about a week stay in Boston to kind of just really convince me that I had a story to tell, and I had a lot of secrets really to tell. Most of it was my youth, and you know how shocking to my colleagues to really read it and go, wow, I had no idea, You know, did I really want to share all of that? Yeah. And that's pretty ballsy, I thought. So,
for sure, also
I did
for
have
your
a story
staff
to tell
members.
And secrets out. But, you know, I also felt like, I can help people, I guess. You know, I could inspire people if I do write it. So it took me 5 years total to write it. So, yeah, she was great. And now, you know, now I'm happy. I mean, it's kind of like it was really therapeutic and cathartic in the end, and I'm a much better, bigger, happier person.
Yeah, it's interesting. We actually had a question for you about whether or not it was therapeutic, because there you do seem to be well, it's all very obviously neat and polished and everything, but it does seem like, you know, as you go through this book, and we don't want to give, you know, spoil the read for people, but it does seem like we're sort of watching you come to terms with feelings about certain relationships in your life and certain aspects of yourself. Is that accurate?
It's so accurate. It's almost like when I was writing it, you kind of have to go back. You have to live it. You have to relive it. You have to step back out of your own business, out of what you built. Because I think, Andrew, you know me. And you have to really assess since you built who I built. I created this person. And then you have to assess who you are, and are you pleased with who you are, and make these changes to be a better person.
Right.
And so I'm a much better person, and I'm a much stronger person. And, you know, and it makes me a stronger business leader, and I'm happy and ready to, you know, go to that next stage in my life, which is, I think... I'm ready to, you know, pass the baton in a way and be able to share knowledge in other ways. And that's what I'm ready for.
Yeah, that sounds good. I always kind of thought that if you put yourself out there, you really have no choice but to accept what comes back to you. And, you know, in this case, this is both Andrew and I are huge fans of the book, and I've seen it been spoken about by our peers in social media and things. And so it's been really, so far, seemingly really well received. I guess I was a little curious, has your staff read it and commented to you at all about it?
Yeah, I gave one of them a book before.
Freak them out a little bit, right? Or what?
Yeah. It's like I gave my daughter the book first.
Yeah, I bet you did.
And she's only 13, and she's like, "Mom, this is really inappropriate for a 13-year-old. I mean, did you have to put the F word in front of mashed potatoes?"
That's great.
It is. It's slightly inappropriate. But my whole 380 employees read it and have a new appreciation, I think. Because they see the beginning of our story and our how the Grupo started and the struggles we went through, especially the newest employees. And we're big on storytelling. We're big on how, you know, really Kat and I started this restaurant, and we're still working together. And the strength of the restaurant, they've been through everything with me, and we're still going strong. So... I'm proud of my staff, really, and we're ready to, you know, like, grow again. Bring it on. Let's do this.
Yeah, that was one of the things Andrew and I were talking about, you know, you and Kat being together for so long and, you know, firing each other up and inspiring each other all the time. But also, you know, I felt like there was a bunch of employees in your company that have been with you for a really long time. And that seems like increasingly more and more difficult, especially in New York. You know, I'm not in the outside markets right now, but it seemed really interesting to me that the way people gravitated to you and stuck with you and just contributed on a really high level with you.
Yeah, and it's so funny because I don't know, Jim, if it's a New England thing or it's just me. That salty thing in me is like, I thrive on loyalty and teamwork, and, you know, no one's better than anybody. And we have that in the restaurant.
Yeah,
our restaurant.
Sounds like
you know, like I said, I'm extremely humble, and I can clean a grease trap just like anybody else. And you know, I'm in it with them.
Right.
So it's, like I said, it's a team. It takes a village to kind of keep it going.
Well
and
said.
We want to be, you know, one of the leaders, and we want to be strong.
Right.
And so it only benefits them in the end. I mean, you know, it's my vision and I need them. So
sure.
Yeah, let's teach. Let's do it.
It might be a New England thing because, you know, I've known Andrew for 15 plus years and I have a house in Rhode Island, and Andrew was up in my house in Rhode Island last year. So I called him up and I said, you know, do you have everything? Can I help you with anything? And he said, you know, I've known you for a long time, right? I said, yeah, you know, you happy? Is everything all right? And he goes, I finally understand you. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
And he's hanging out with these people up here in New England. Like, I see. It's like this salt of the earth thing that, you know, we came up from. And, you know, we're roughly the same age and we saw a lot of the same things growing up. And so, yeah, you might be onto something there with it's a little bit of the New England fabric in us that, you know, has helped us become who we are.
Right. Right.
Barbara, I'm curious. You know, I was reading through the book and there are places, especially in the childhood scenes, which obviously are the things that happened longest ago, the level of detail of neighborhoods, stores, cars, it seems
sights,
really
sounds, yeah, smells, sight,
everything.
It was amazing.
It's really I'm just wondering, is that how you experience life? Did you go back to some of these? I mean, I know they're not that far away for you. Did you revisit certain locations? Is it just the way your brain works? How did you get all that into this book? Because it was really striking to me.
Well, I mean, I haven't left, so.
Sure.
And, you know, Monton's 5 minutes from where I grew up, yep. And I still have my gang of friends. My, you know, I still hang out at the Shamrock, and it's impossible for me to forget it. And with my gang of 28 friends, we still get together. I mean, we all just turned in, we're 50. So they remind me and about my first car, you know, stealing a bus. And they have photos. You know, it's just, it's impossible for me to forget any of this. And also, I kept journals since I was 5, believe it or not. And, we're still a tight-knit group. They were like my buddies. They're my strength.
Right.
We kind of raised each other.
And that keeps all those stories kind of right there. You probably retell some of these stories.
All the time, because I was the one who friggin' made them laugh all the time. I was the crazy one.
Yeah, you were like the major domo of it.
Yeah, exactly. I was the leader. I was like, come on, we're doing this. I could get them to do anything.
You know, Barbara, it's funny. You said a few minutes ago that we know each other. You know, we've met a few times. I guess we've had a meal or two in a group situation. But you know, I was struck in this book. You know, I've always sort of experienced you as I was going to say tough. I don't want that to sound like a negative thing. I guess strong. I've always experienced you as a very strong person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this book is very open. You know, I think we see you insecure. We see that there's actually what I would say, and this is often the case with people who seem a certain way, and I've experienced with many chefs, that what a lot of people perceive as this sort of imperiousness or toughness is sometimes a shyness. You come off a little bit as vulnerable. I was really surprised by how moved you were by the sort of ebb and flow of recognition, awards, nominations when you didn't win the award. You really seemed to mean a surprising amount to me as you relate it.
Right. I say you know me. I forget that you don't know the real me.
Right. This is what I'm saying. But it all seems
like I know you because I feel like I know you because I could get you to do anything. Like, you're the type I could get to I could make you laugh when I wanted to.
Yes.
I could manipulate you in a good way to get you to laugh or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
No, you didn't know the real me. Like, the real, the insecure me, the me who, the you know, the secrets I hide is like, yes, the insecurities, yes, the, you know, the weak me, and I do come off strong for sure. But that's a false me. And what I said earlier in the show is that now I'm happy because I'm happy to be me. You know, it's just,
right.
This is who I am.
Was there a hesitancy at all to reveal that part of yourself in the book, or was this? I mean, it seems to me when you said, you know, you're reluctant to do the book. I mean, two things that people have said to me when I've talked to them about maybe, you know, helping them write a memoir as a collaborator. One is what you said, like, you know, they hear the word memoir and they think, well, I'm too young, I'm not finished. You know, like, it's not time for that yet. The other is I've had certain people say to me, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to really do it. Like, if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to write, like, the press release version of my life. I'm going to really put it all out there. And it seems to me like you sort of fall into that category of writer. Is that accurate? Did you feel like if you were going to do this thing that you had to really just strip it all down and just put it all out there and let the chips fall where they may?
Yeah, you have to do it. If you're going to do it, you're going to do it. Because there's no point in writing it if you're not going to be honest with yourself and just put it all out there, right?
Yeah, and, you know, maybe it helps people understand. Like, it's almost like there's two versions of you, which obviously there isn't, but, you know, sharing on both levels. So it's kind of like, you know, the insecurities covering up for self-esteem or so on, and then the strength, teaching both characters to get along with each other, or introducing both characters to each other, and just the way you did it, it really connected the dots in a really special and meaningful way for me when I read it.
I mean, it makes sense because you have to face it. So if I'm going to move forward, I mean, the only way I think I was going to move forward and you know, mostly for my own being, but then secondly for my own staff and for my career, I had to be honest and say, I can do this. I can, you know, deal with the last situation in my company and really take hold of it and grow.
Right.
Well, and not let it get, you know, not let it get to me. Third time's a, it won't happen a third time, that's for sure.
You know, there's something that Jimmy and I have talked about on the show before, and I think that it's so funny. There's these themes that come up in the cooking life that they seem to come up so much, but they always seem to come up and differently for each individual. But this idea of, and it really in this book, I think as much as I've ever seen it, I think because of, you know, this childhood you had in Southie and the way you describe it in the book, you know, this notion of the kitchen and of this career, almost like a sanctuary, like a salvation. You know, you talk, I thought, very touchingly about, you know, your mother's, you know, the little tricks she had and the dishes she made at home, you know, the way she made tuna salad or the meatballs.
Yes.
I thought this was my trick. I make my meatballs with saltines soaked in milk.
Yeah.
Yes. How I got there is a long story, but you talk about that was sort of her way of showing love, right? And then, you know, you find your way eventually. And we were struck, you know, reading the book, the job that you had.
At the warehouse.
The Port Terminals Company. Yeah. You had this job for 4 long years. That's a long time out of someone's life. Before kind of going and sort of pursuing, you know, what ended up being, you know, this amazing career you've had. But can you just talk for a minute of this? And you talk about maybe this book could help, you know, other people. I'm sure you don't just mean young cooks out there.
No.
But this is really a profession that seems open to people of virtually any background, any circumstance, you know, if they're willing to work for it.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I go to a lot of career fairs and culinary schools and, you know, or any kind of high school, and I'm fascinated with a lot of the sort of immigrants or, you know, migrants that come here, and they're usually doing things that their parents want them to do in terms of, like, they really want me to graduate, and they really want me to be a lawyer, or they really want me to be a doctor, but that's not what I want to do. And I would say, well, are they a doctor or are they a lawyer? And they would say no. And I said, well, what do you want to do? Because you will fail at being a doctor or a lawyer if that's not what you want to do. If you're not passionate about it, your life will not be content. So go for the passion and do what you want to do. Because your life, you have one life, and you know, you can do anything that you want. If you're passionate about it, money will follow. And don't go for money. Go for what you're passionate about. I mean, you know, these kids come out of culinary school and they want to be on television.
They want a TV show.
Or they think they're going to make money out of it. And it's I find it impossible to make money in the restaurant industry this day and age. It just gets tougher.
Yeah, it always was low margins, and now it's, you know,
right.
Every year. I have a, a little thought I was having, a question for you. What is the beverage on the cover of the book? Is that a glass of wine?
On ice.
Well, I knew it. can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Container, right?
Yeah, like, and then we would know you would have been in the kitchen drinking, though.
right, which I don't.
At least this you could be in the office or at home this way.
Always at home in a jelly glass or
yes,
you know.
Yeah, a ball jar, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that, you know, significant of the story in some way? You know, the high and the lows, or is there some other meaning in there? Or
I think it is just part of the whole story. Now I'm in control. Like now. A lot of trigger points in the book, just in terms of the trauma and then the life of a chef sometimes. Yeah. And
even your home ec teacher is the trigger point. You know, there are some really good positive ones in that book as well, in your book.
Oh, God, yeah.
But
then, you know, I still love wine, and I met, you know, through this life, you meet the most amazing winemakers, and the thought of not being able to have wine with great meals is somewhat, you feel handicapped, and so I refuse to let that happen to me as well. So I'm in my last 4 years, I went to writing this book, major therapy, and I know now that how much it could really take a person down if you let it.
Sure, absolutely.
And you know, now I'm in control of it, and love my life even more. And in control of it, whereas we have help for our own company, and, you know, not throwing extravagant Christmas parties, and life is not based on a ship drink anymore, put it that way.
Well said.
Can we just talk for 1 second, since the news is so fresh, this Time Magazine honor?
Right.
Did you know this?
Or in the book, fuck.
Did you know this was coming, or what's?
I knew a week ago. That was it. They gave me a week.
Wow. And what was your thought when you found that out? Congratulations.
I thought it was spam mail. Like, I was
of course.
Like, it came through like, don't open spam, and it's for my publisher.
Oh, that's a little bit like your Food and Wine Award with the FedEx envelope.
Oh, my God, same thing. I didn't open it, and I was like,
only maybe just a little bigger.
And then
this
I was like, are you sure? And I'm like, if they only knew who I really was, or how messy my car is, or, you know.
Clearly they haven't read my book.
right? And then I'm like, then I'm like, did somebody vote for me?
Yeah, who nominated me?
And then I read it this morning, and it was Padma, right? So
oh, wow.
I'm assuming it was Padma who put me in there.
Nice.
And then to be a pioneer or on the first page, I was like, shit. And then there's a good picture. I was like, wow, that's a nice picture.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Chef Barbara Lynch. The book is Out of Line, A Life of Playing with Fire. There's a million. We didn't want to spoil things, Barbara. We thought we'd talk a little more in the abstract today. But honestly, for people listening, there have been a million chef memoirs in the last few years. I think this one, as much as it, first of all, the honesty of it is amazing. And watching somebody go through, it's like watching a Polaroid develop. I mean, just watching this person kind of materialize and develop before your eyes.
Kind of a culmination for me. Like, you've been putting yourself out there on the middle of the plate, the center of the plate. You've been putting yourself out there, you know, raising money and opening restaurants and being fierce but being vulnerable. And then this one kind of connected the dots. This is the backstory to, you know, show everybody the other story behind the strong woman story.
All of which is to say, Barbara, you have canals of steel.
Yep.
Thank you. I'll send you a T-shirt.
Excellent.
It's been great having you today. Thank you. Congrats on the book, and have fun the rest of the way promoting it. And for everyone listening, we can't recommend it highly enough, Chef Barbara Lynch.
Sorry. I hope I see you guys soon. Thanks.
I hope so, too.
Yes,
thank
indeed.
You.
Thanks, Barbara.
You chugs. Thanks. Bye.
And we're going to take a break, and when The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew returns, Chef Brock Johnson of the Dahlia Lounge in Seattle is here in the studio, and we'll have a conversation. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. Or what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We are now joined by Chef Brock Johnson. Welcome, Chef.
Thank you.
Brock is the chef at the Dahlia Lounge, which is, I think we can say at this point, I mean, it's 28 years old now. It's an institution in Seattle, I guess even in the Pacific Northwest. It was Tom Douglas's first restaurant. Tom, of course, is a very prolific chef in Seattle and has been for a very long time. Brock's been the executive chef of the restaurant since 2009, having previously cooked at Lola, which is another Tom Douglas restaurant. And we're thrilled to have you here. I guess, you know, the first thing we always like to do with people who are here from another city is just kind of check in on the city, the region. If I throw it out there really generally, Seattle, Pacific Northwest, the restaurant scene these days, how's it going out there?
Oh, it's been very interesting. Seattle is booming. We've changed so much in the past few years with all the tech. Seattle's so competitive now, restaurant-wise, and really in all industries. We've had to kind of stay on our toes.
You can't just coast being like, we're Tom Douglas's first restaurant.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
very competitive. Different parts of town are changing quickly. Pioneer Square in the South End is becoming a hot spot. South Lake Union, where the Amazon buildings are coming in. We're getting 1,000 new Amazon employees a week right now.
Wow.
And it's really changing the landscape of, let's say, lunch business.
That's
for
almost incomprehensible.
Yeah. So it's been very interesting. We've had to stay on our toes. And last year was a very difficult year. Some legislation was passed by the city. The minimum wage increases. We have things like predictive scheduling coming down the pike. So a lot of really important changes to our industry.
Mm-hmm.
Last year was tough, but at the same time, all of these new customers, new diners in town, we feel lucky to have them as well.
I wonder if working there for as long as you have, you know, I used to, I guess in the mid 90s, spend a lot of time in Seattle, and the whole mindset of that city to me was very interesting because it's geographically relative to the rest of the country for a pretty big city. I mean, I think of it almost like kind of Philadelphia sized for people on the East Coast for a comparison. It's pretty remote geographically, but I always had this feeling like Seattle had a lot of pride, almost didn't need the, you know, you'll talk to people often in San Francisco will say to me they feel a little bit dissed by, you know, the East Coast media and all that. I always felt like Seattle just didn't care. Like, there was so much going on there. It was, there was the whole, at that time, the whole brewery, microbrew thing was taking off. Yep. And the coffee thing was taking off. And I remember there was, I don't know if it's, they still have it. They had their own late night live Saturday night comedy show.
Oh yeah.
That only aired locally. And I thought, wow, they don't even need Saturday Night Live here. They have their own Saturday Night Live, whatever it was called. But do you experience the city that way? It seems like a very sort of self-contained, proud in its way, but not really kind of needing outside validation.
Yeah, I mean, we're still always looking for that with our sports teams. We definitely want some shout-outs and could use that support.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we're quite content with what we have. I mean, we're still a small city population-wise.
Yeah.
And we cherish the bounty that we have.
It's amazing.
It surrounds us. So.
What in particular? Like, let's start. Let's move the conversation over to what you do in your restaurant. What is what really excites you locally, and what are you most happy to have your hands on there?
Well, there's just so much, but kind of three phases right now that I'm kind of really digging into. We've got tons of work we're doing with sustainable seafood, Alaska wild salmon. And that whole piece, working with smaller fishermen all the time. This year, we're actually working with a kind of a boutique fisherman who's going to be able to tag his fish, and we'll be able to put on the menu exactly where that fish was caught. We're really excited about that. His name is Tom Kelly, TK Fresh Fish, and that's super cool. So there's the seafood aspect of the Northwest, the shellfish regions, and then there's the Washington wine. We've been doing an AVA series at Dahlia where we highlight a specific AVA from Walla Walla to Columbia Gorge, Columbia Valley, Red Mountain, etc. Tons of beautiful winemakers in the region. Washington wine is stronger than ever. And then we also have our farm angle, Prosser Farm. We're in our eighth or ninth year, I believe. And that's really us just trying to kind of walk the walk.
Yeah.
It's our own farm. There's been a ton of learning involved. It's been a long road, but we're literally growing tons and tons of food for our joints now, our 20 businesses in Seattle that are all within 10 blocks of each other.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And the chefs are becoming more and more involved. We're actually doing a chef plant, which is our annual kind of get together where all the chefs of our restaurants head out to Prosser. It's about a 4.5 hour drive to Eastern Washington. We get our hands dirty and we plant all of our starts from the greenhouse.
How great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's an excellent connection, huh?
What?
Super cool.
From the earth to the plate.
Yeah.
all through your hands.
Yeah, yeah. You know.
Table to farm.
Yeah, you know, I've always felt like recently the local sustainable organic is, it's a lot of buzzwords, and it doesn't necessarily have that meaning when you see it on a menu. So we're doing our best to kind of walk the walk, as I say, and really incorporate that into our culture. Jackie Cross, Tom's business partner and wife, runs that farm and spends half her year out there now, and that's her passion. So we're getting our hands dirty in the soil, and then there's only so much impact you can make on the environment through growing your own food. There's a ton of work left to do in the oceans, and that's why we're speaking out for Bristol Bay, the Pebble Mine, for instance. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're talking about the Salish Sea now, which is a region that we cherish that has some of the most beautiful salmon runs in the world. So, you know, working that angle as well.
Yeah. What's the scene like amongst the chef? I mean, 20 business, 20 joints within one company. You guys are almost a city unto yourself.
Right.
But what's this community like among chefs in that town? You know, it's I've always thought Seattle is up there with, I've thought this for like probably 20 years, among the most underrated. You know, 20 years ago, I felt like people had no idea how many like 2-star New York Times level restaurants were in that city. Even then, I mean, it's always had it's been brimming with maybe not the most fancy, you know, 4-star level, just because that's not necessarily how people want to eat, but really just great food, really good service, really passionate people in the front and back of the house. What's the community like amongst people of, in outside of the Thomas Douglas universe?
Yeah, no, I think the Seattle restaurant culture and community is coming along nicely. And, you know, I think what's even more significant beyond our own city is actually our connections with Vancouver and Portland.
Right.
That all feels Northwest.
Yep.
And we do have connections between the cities.
It's a little like New York, Boston, Philly.
Yeah.
Close enough to be uber competitive, mm-hmm. but yet support each other as well.
Absolutely. A couple of years ago, we did a like an I-5 corridor, which is the north-south freeway that runs, you know, the West Coast. We did an I-5 corridor tasting series and featured Portland chefs like Gabe Rucker from Le Pigeon and some guys from Vancouver. And that was really cool to kind of cross-pollinate there. And we're thinking about now taking this AVA series that we're working on and incorporating some Oregon wineries, the Willamette Valley. Just we want to show that off to the world too. So
sure.
There's more and more collaboration regionally with winemakers and chefs than ever before. So we're excited about that.
What about Dahlia Lounge? So you've been at the helm there now for about 8 years.
Yep, that's right.
Tom's this big. He probably would never use the word mogul. I mean, you guys, you refer to the restaurants as joints. But, you know, that's the first one that there's a lot of history there. It's beloved. What was it like when you first got the nod to step in and run that kitchen? And what's the give and take like now between you and the guy who started the whole thing? How do you go about, you know, writing new menus and the day to day?
We call the Dahlia our flagship restaurant.
Sure.
And when I first got the nod, I felt in over my head for sure. And looking back, one of the brilliant things about Tom and this company is the trust that he puts in others. It's tough sometimes for me to let my sous chef put a new dish on the menu. Can you imagine giving your business to a young person? But the learning is so invaluable. I can see that's how he empowers his people.
Yeah.
And I'm so appreciative for that opportunity and learned so much in these 8 years. Tom's biggest dream is to have his people run the joints like it's their own. And I think that's why, kind of speaking to Barbara's point, there's that loyalty.
Yeah.
Because he believes in us and gives us opportunity and trust.
Yeah.
And so that's why I've embraced my role so much. And as far as writing menus and things, he's okay with my evolution as a chef. I appreciate that. And
so you do your thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely do my thing. And, I've had great mentors, Tom and his other business partner, Eric Tanaka,
mm-hmm.
Great mentors have allowed me to be kind of dynamic and always change and grow. And that's really what kind of fuels me is kind of a constant evolution of my style.
Yeah. I just would love to talk because it kind of connects this with what we were talking to Barbara about. You spent some time at some point teaching culinary arts in a high school.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, you know, the profession obviously has changed in the last, 15, 20 years. You know, it used to be, you know, certainly for someone of Barbara's generation, you know, there's a lot of people who were really lost without cooking coming along. Now, you know, there's kids on TV, 10-year-olds on MasterChef Junior.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, people see it as a path to maybe fame and fortune. But what kind of kids did you encounter? Did you still encounter people for whom it was like, wow, this is like really, it's a good thing this is coming into their life? Do you still see those kind of kids?
Yes.
You do?
Yes, absolutely. And I actually started in a high school program, kind of a an elevated home ec class. It was called Culinary Arts.
Yeah.
I kind of wasn't one of those kids on the fringe. I was more mainstream athlete, that kind of thing. But somehow it grabbed me. I'm kind of one of those people that, or one of those chefs where cooking definitely found me. I didn't seek it out. I just loved the feel of it. My senior year of high school, I spent, you know, two periods or three periods, half of my day in our little kitchen. And I loved going to work. I got a four-year degree up in Bellingham at Western, but always wanted to be in the kitchen. I'd always rather be at work than at school. And teaching is kind of my backup plan. Both my parents are educators, okay, were educators. They took it a long way. My mom was even a superintendent at one point. So I kind of have that in my blood, and I wanted to test the waters. I don't have a teaching certificate, but I was able to get kind of a probationary certificate for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is a great opportunity to work with kids.
Yeah.
I would love to coach someday too. If I can ever get my schedule in order, right? And make it to soccer practice.
But very compatible. See. What you do in a kitchen as a chef is very compatible with being a coach, no?
Yes. No, oh, absolutely. I mean, that's how we frame our feedback in our company now is coaching.
Yeah.
And it's something I'm passionate about. I enjoy it. But that time I spent in the classroom was a huge learning experience. And I still am... I still volunteer at my old high school. I do chef dinners and try to stay in touch with those kids.
That's great.
Because I think cooking still attracts the type of young person that you're alluding to.
Yeah.
And I think cooking can be a very important career track for some of those kids.
Well, it's funny. I've had this debate with people who sometimes disagree, sometimes they still disagree when we're done. Sometimes I turn them around. But, you know, there is a lot, just traditionally, there is this type. We've had Kat Kinsman on the show. You know, there is this type of person who is almost metabolically incompatible with traditional classroom education, who plugs right into a kitchen. You hear these things all the time. Like, they don't like to sit still. They'd rather be on their feet. They like doing things with their hands, right? They like the busyness of a kitchen.
Well, yeah, they don't find school gratifying at all. And to Brock's point,
yeah,
you know, you do this thing and you're like, holy shit, this is gratifying. And dare I say, I might just be good at this and I have no training. You know, like, that's pretty inspiring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you taken any of the kids from the classroom onto the line yet?
Absolutely. Well, of course we're,
it's a head recruiting.
Well, yeah. Finding why not, right? Is so difficult these days. That's partly why I'm still involved is
once
recruiting.
A fisherman, always a fisherman.
Yeah.
I should ask. It may be too early. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. The 30th anniversary of that restaurant is only. Is there any idea what's going to happen? Or
well, we did. You know, we had a huge party for the 25th. We haven't actually
still a ways
gone
off.
Over that. Yeah.
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 Okay. Well, it's great to meet you.
Thanks for meeting you also.
Thanks for coming out to Bushwick.
Yeah, thank you.
And I apologize, Brock. We didn't tell you this was happening today, but you're our last ever guest on the Front Burner.
Ever.
We are. This is our last show, Jimmy.
Yes.
This is the end of the season.
You can't see, but I have a little tear in my eye.
Yeah. So there's a lot of reasons. What's the big reason for you, Jimmy? I'll let you speak for yourself.
I guess, you know, from 99 till 04, I opened four or five businesses, and I haven't done an opening in 10 years. And my next goal is to open Red Cats around America. So I'm seeking property right now in Providence, Rhode Island, which I thought would be the next kind of closest, fun, not too large city. You know, I don't want to be, I grew up in Philadelphia. I grew up in New England. I don't want to be in Boston. I don't want to be in Philly, but there's something about Rhode Island and smaller cities like Brock was alluding to. And, so, you know, I can't run a business here, run a business in another state and run a radio show the way that, you know, we want to run it. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you, what's, well, what are you going to do?
I just finished a book I spent 5 years on and yes. I've got three projects.
I cannot wait to read that book. What's it called?
Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Subtitles being worked out.
The coming of age of American.
The creation of an American profession in the 70s and 80s.
I cannot wait.
But I've got three new books that I'm trying to get off the launch pad. Also, for me, I'm not going to speak for you. You know, doing what this show was born as, which is a current event show, in the current climate, the current events of your profession, they just seem to pale a little bit
far
next to what's happening in the world.
Real
so
current events.
It's just been hard for me to get up for that each week or to feel like it matters in some regards. But
yeah, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. Though.
That's true.
Of course it matters.
But I will say I am going to be back, I believe, in the fall. And
I've already
been
be too.
Chatting to the folks at Heritage. There's a sort of single host show I've had in mind.
You are too good of an interviewer not to put yourself out there, Andrew.
But there's a sort of interview format show that I'll probably be doing, probably maybe even with the Heritage people in the fall.
Will you have me on? Maybe,
yes, of course.
Sometime?
I would be honored. Is that a real question?
It's my attempt.
It's our
at
perfect
humor.
Last exchange. Before we do sign off, though, first of all, David Tadashore, our engineer for the last couple of seasons, thank you. Waving
you,
from the booth. And Aaron Fairbanks, the former executive director of Heritage, Jack Inslee, who used to be a big part of the network and was our original engineer. Katie, who's the current executive director, who's been incredibly supportive and very understanding of our decision and of maybe me coming back in the fall. Patrick and the whole gang at Heritage.
Yeah, all the fellow hosts that have been supportive of us.
All the fellow hosts.
Really, really fun and rewarding.
We haven't come to enough happy hours, but we've been there in spirit.
Please forgive us. at least my day job keeps me really busy.
So with that, Brock, thanks for being our last guest, man.
Thank you for
good
having
meeting
me.
You.
Thank you, Brock.
A big thank you again to Barbara Lynch, who still called in, even though she's one of the 100 most
right. What a great excuse
people
to
on
blow
the planet.
Us up. I can't speak to Heritage Radio right now because I'm very busy with Time Magazine.
And with that, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks to those of you who have emailed, tweeted, Instagrammed, Facebook back to us. It's
supported
been,
us.
It's been
thank
awesome. And thank you, Jimmy.
It's been great to do this with you, Andrew. I'm going to miss it.
All right. And with
maybe,
that,
maybe then we'll write another book together.
Yeah, maybe we'll do another cookbook.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Not a memoir. I'm too young.
with that, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
And we will not see you back here next time on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.